Imagine you're standing in a really busy emergency room.
Okay.
And in bed one, there's a patient who just fell off a ladder. The doctor wheels in the X-ray machine, takes an image,
Let me
and
guess, a broken bone.
exactly. Boom. There it is on the screen, a jagged, glowing white line right across the radius bone.
Right.
The diagnosis is clean, it's undeniable. And the treatment plan, a cast, maybe some pins, it's just obvious to everyone in the
It's
room.
very straightforward.
Yeah. But now look at bed two. The patient is sitting there, trembling, chest heaving, absolutely convinced they're about to die. Like their heart is just pounding out of their chest.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
So the doctor runs an EKG, draws blood for cardiac enzymes, does a chest X-ray, and everything comes back completely normal.
Completely clear.
Right. So the doctor walks in, pulls back the curtain, and says, "Good news, your heart is fine. It's just a panic attack. Follow up with symptiatry." And just like that, the feeling of precision totally
It
vanishes.
does. The contrast is really jarring, isn't it?
Yeah, it's wild.
Because in bed one, you have this ontology of broken mechanics. But in bed two, the medical tools we usually rely on to make the invisible visible, they suddenly fail us.
They just don't work.
Right? The patient's suffering is immense, obviously. But because we can't photograph it or measure it in a blood draw, we label it and just push it into a completely different realm.
We really do. We end up looking at a diagnostic landscape that is entirely murky. And if you are listening to this right now and you have ever interfaced with the mental health system, either for yourself or a loved one, you know this frustration intimately.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know what it feels like to be handed a label that somehow feels just, I don't know, too small for the reality of your suffering. And that tension is our exact focus today.
It's a big one.
It is,
Yeah.
because today is a very specific date. It's May 26, 2026, which is the exact day of the release of a massive paradigm-shifting academic white paper by Dr. Bacharachsarlai.
Right. The paper's titled Living Coherence in Neuropsychiatric Disease.
That's the one. And our mission for you on this deep dive is pretty ambitious.
To say the least.
Yeah. By the time we wrap up, we want you to completely reevaluate what mental illness actually is. We are moving away from thinking of psychiatric conditions as just broken brains or chemical
We're
imbalances.
dismantling that entirely.
Exactly. And instead, we're looking at them as disturbances in the very process of living. Now, I brought in our resident expert to help navigate this because, frankly, the theoretical groundwork here is pretty dense.
It is dense, yeah. It's a heavy
Yeah.
text, but it's necessary. I mean, it pulls from areas of science that don't usually talk to each other.
Like what?
Well, we're looking at neurobiology, phenomenology, and active cognitive science and public health epidemiology.
Wow. All of that in one paper.
Yeah, all fused into a framework the author is calling a transdiagnostic psychiatry. And to understand why this is making such waves, we have to look at the currently fragmented state of modern psychiatry.
It's pretty messy out there.
It's basically a crisis of competing realities. If you go to a standard clinic, they use the DSM-5TR or the ICD-11.
The standard manual.
Exactly. These are categorical frameworks. They operate under the assumption that mental disorders are discrete boxes. You check 5 out of 9 symptoms, you get the label of major depressive disorder.
And if you check a different set, you get generalized anxiety disorder.
Precisely. But the research world has been pushing back against those boxes for a while now.
Yeah, I mean, the NIMH practically abandoned the DSM for funding purposes years ago, didn't they?
They did. They
Yeah.
introduced RDOC, the research domain criteria. The NIMH basically looked at the DSM and said, these behavioral checklists aren't giving us actual biological targets.
Oh, interesting.
So RDOC focuses on observable behavior and neurobiology. They look at domains like fear learning or reward processing across different brain circuits.
Okay, so that's two competing frameworks.
And in parallel to that, you have the HITOP consortium.
Right, the dimensional taxonomy, folks.
Yes. What's fascinating here is that the HITOP researchers argue that psychopathology isn't about distinct boxes or isolated brain circuits. To them, it's about continuous spectra.
Meaning what exactly?
Meaning someone doesn't have depression like they have the flu. Rather, they sit at an extreme end of an internalizing spectrum that literally everyone is on.
Okay, that makes sense.
But wait, if that wasn't enough, we also have an active psychiatry,
Oh, right.
which looks at all the neurobiologists and says, you're all treating the brain like a computer locked in a jar. And activists argue that the mind is embodied and deeply embedded in the physical world.
Man, okay, so if I'm a patient just trying to navigate the system, I'm getting caught in the crossfire of all these competing ontologies, as the paper calls them. Like,
Right.
one doctor is treating my brain circuits, another is treating my trauma history, another is telling me I'm on a spectrum, another is looking at my poverty or my environment.
It's exhausting. And Dr. Saley argues that these are all partial truths being mistaken for the whole picture. A purely biomedical account dialing in on a serotonin receptor completely misses the patient's lived experience, what it actually feels like to be them.
Right, the human element.
But a purely social account focusing solely on systemic oppression or trauma misses the biological specificity of how that suffering is ravaging the body's endocrine system.
Okay, let's unpack this for a second. Wait, so is the author saying the DSM is wrong and we should just throw out our current diagnoses?
No, not at all.
Because for a lot of people, finally getting that ADHD or autism or OCD diagnosis is like the first time their life makes sense. It unlocks accommodations. It gives them a community.
It's a vital concern, absolutely. And the paper explicitly warns against discarding our current diagnostic manuals. The DSM remains indispensable.
Okay, phew.
We need it for clinical communication, so doctors know what they're talking about when they consult on a case. We need it for epidemiology, insurance coding, and exactly as you said, for identity and access to services.
So the boxes stay, but what are we doing with them then?
We are recognizing that the diagnosis is just the surface pattern. The DSM describes the shape of the collapse, but it doesn't describe the process of the collapse.
Ah, I see.
Think about it. Symptoms overlap heavily. Sleep disturbance is in almost every major DSM category. Two people can have the exact same diagnosis of major depression, but they took completely different biological and environmental pathways to get there.
Right. So if you've ever felt like a psychiatric diagnosis didn't capture the full story of your life, this is exactly why this paper matters to you.
Exactly. The new framework is a foundational grammar beneath the diagnosis. To understand this missing layer, we actually have to go back to the literal beginning.
Like the biological definition of life itself.
Yes. The paper introduces these five foundational principles of living coherence. And the first one is autopoiesis.
Autopoiesis, let's dig into that.
It's a concept originally developed by biologists Humberto Maturana and Francisco Varela. It literally means self-creation. It is the minimal organization required for something to be considered alive. A living system is materially open. It takes in food, oxygen, energy from the outside, but it is organizationally closed.
Meaning it uses those outside materials solely to regenerate its own internal components, right? Like sleeping, eating, metabolizing.
Precisely. A rock doesn't do this. A rock just sits there and slowly erodes. But a living cell must constantly synthesize proteins and repair its membrane just to maintain its boundary, to stay distinct from the environment.
To be alive is to be in a constant, active state of self-conservation.
Yes. And because we don't exist in a vacuum, we have the second principle. Structural coupling.
Which means a living unity cannot exist in isolation. It has to maintain a viable relationship with its medium or its environment.
Right. The organism and the environment co-develop.
Okay. I was trying to wrap my head around this earlier, and I came up with an analogy. Tell me if this works.
Let's hear it.
It's like thinking of a house plant, say a fern. Autopoiesis is the internal work, the plant photosynthesizing, drawing up water through its stem to keep its cellular structure from decaying.
Okay, I'm with you.
Structural coupling is the specific relationship that exact fern has with the humidity in your living room, the amount of sunlight hitting the window, and the exact pH of the soil you put it in.
That's a great way to put it. Now, if the fern begins to wilt, what does a purely internal biomedical model do?
I guess it looks inside the stem. It says, the cellular walls are breaking down. We have wilting disorder. And maybe it tries to inject a chemical into the stem to stiffen the walls.
Exactly. But the life coherence model says you cannot understand why the plant is wilting by only looking inside a stem. You have to look at the coupling.
Right. The living room is too dry or the sun is too direct.
The organism is trying to conserve itself. That's autopoiesis. But the medium is demanding more resources than the plant can regenerate.
That reframes so much of human suffering, because historically, psychiatry treats distress as a mind trapped inside a body.
Yeah, very often, yes.
But autopoiesis restores you as a living unity. It explains why severe depression isn't just a cognitive state of feeling sad. Your sleep architecture shatters, your appetite disappears, your immune function drops.
The entire living unity is struggling to maintain itself. And structural coupling means that trauma, poverty, school environments, or safe neighborhoods aren't just backgrounds.
They become literally embodied histories.
Exactly. What's fascinating here is how this applies to something like burnout. In a colloquial sense, we treat burnout like a tired battery. You know, you just need a vacation to recharge.
Oh, totally. Just like a long weekend.
But the paper frames burnout as a prolonged, non-viable structural coupling. The organism is locked in a relationship with demands that chronically exceed its margin for autopoietic recovery.
Wow. The environment is basically extracting more regulatory energy than the organism can synthesize.
Precisely.
Okay, but here's my question. Plants don't get panic attacks.
Right.
They don't have existential dread in the grocery store. So how do we get from a basic biological organism to complex human emotional suffering?
That brings us to the next three principles, starting with valence and emotioning.
Okay, let's dive into that.
When an organism interacts with its environment, those perturbations aren't neutral. Some interactions are better for viability, and some are worse. That's valence.
Like a bacteria moving towards sugar and away from acid.
Exactly. But in animals with nervous systems, that evolves into something much more dynamic called emotioning. And the paper defines emotions not as private, abstract feelings floating in a mind, but as bodily dispositions that open or close specific domains of possible action.
Okay, give me an example of that.
If you encounter a predator, your fear isn't just a subjective experience of feeling scared. Your biology is reorganizing itself in real time. Blood shifts to your muscles, your heart rate spikes. Fear opens the domain of escape. Anger opens the domain of boundary defense.
Here's where it gets really interesting, because the paper points out that rationality is never emotionally neutral. A proposal, like, say, feedback from a boss, heard in a state of trust, is biologically different from the exact same words heard in a state of humiliation.
Absolutely. And this is where the concept of interoception becomes vital. Interoception is the nervous system's inward registration of the body. Your brain and body are continually predicting and regulating internal signals.
It's constantly checking in, like, how are we doing?
Yes. And drawing on the work of Catherine Pell Kaufman, the paper calls this emotional sentience.
Life feeling how life is going. I love that quote.
It's brilliant. It's the felt evaluative self-regulatory dimension of life. Your emotional system is the organism reading its own internal state to gauge whether its coupling with the world is currently viable.
So if you're listening, think about how you experience your own body, like the fluttering stomach before a big presentation or the tight chest when you get a vague email from your manager.
A lot of times we just want to suppress those feelings.
Right. The paper suggests these aren't just annoying symptoms. They are your organism's attempt to regulate significance.
And in psychiatric conditions, this interoceptive system gets altered. The body literally misinterprets its own regulatory signals. Take panic disorder, for example.
Okay.
In panic, you might have a normal spike in bodily arousal. Maybe you drank too much coffee.
Mm.
But the interoceptive system misreads that ordinary signal as a catastrophic threat. The body becomes terrified of its own internal regulation. Panic is bodily arousal appearing as a catastrophe.
Okay. I'm totally tracking the biology here. It's a stunning model. But I have to play devil's advocate.
Go for it.
If I am a doctor sitting in a clinic and a patient is across from me in profound distress, I can't exactly muse about autopoiesis and structural coupling, right? How does this actually translate into clinical practice to help you, the patient?
Well, Dr. Saley bridges that gap with what the paper calls the seven primitives clinical grammar.
Seven primitives.
Okay, yeah. It is a transdiagnostic formulation method meant to locate exactly how life has become constrained and where repair can begin. The seven steps are constraint, margin, state, disturbance, perception, regulation, and options.
That's a lot of abstract terms. I want to try building this organically. Let's take a patient dealing with severe obsessive compulsive disorder.
Okay, perfect example.
Say they're washing their hands for 4 hours a day, their skin is raw, they've lost their job because they literally can't leave the bathroom. How do these primitives map onto that?
Let's start with perception, what has become salient to the organism. In this case, a doorknob isn't just an object, it is saturated with lethal threat. The organism's interoception is screaming that the coupling is non-viable.
So the body demands an action to restore safety, and that action is the hand washing.
Exactly. The hand washing is the regulation. It is how the system is coping. But here's the tragic irony. In attempting to regulate the threat, the washing behavior creates a massive constraint. The person is physically blocked from engaging with the rest of their world.
Right. What is blocked or trapped? And because they can't leave the house, they lose their job, they weren't sleeping, this depletes their margin.
Yes. Margin is the reserve capacity that remains, like sleep or social support. When margin is drained, their present bodily ineffective state becomes exhausted and hypersensitized.
And because their state is so depleted, Any new disturbance, like, I don't know, a family member coming over, generates an even more terrifying perception, demanding more regulation.
It's a devastating feedback loop. And the seventh primitive is options. What viable paths can be safely reopened? Notice how this changes the clinical target.
Yeah.
If you just target the regulation, like physically stopping them from washing their hands, without addressing the perception of threat and their depleted margin, you will send their system into absolute biological terror.
Okay, that makes total sense for an outpatient setting, but let me push back here. What if someone is in a severe crisis, say a psychotic break or a profound addiction withdrawal where they're hallucinating? Do we really have time to sit around mapping out these seven abstract primitives?
It's the most important question to ask, and the paper is extremely disciplined about this. There is a strict section on red flags and rule-outs. Acute risk, delirium, seizures, profound instability, or safeguarding concerns require immediate biomedical stabilization. The life coherence grammar does not delay life-saving care.
So you still use the heavy medication in the ER to stabilize them?
You have to. If an organism's autopoiesis is moments away from catastrophic failure, your only job is to stop the collapse. This grammar guides what comes after stabilization, so they don't end up right back in the ER a month later.
To make this really concrete, let's look at how this grammar fundamentally changes how we view specific, recognizable mental health conditions.
Let's do it.
The paper groups them into disorder families. Let's start with the logics of threat and collapse, depression, anxiety, and PTSD.
Conventionally, depression is a checklist of symptoms, sadness, fatigue, whatever. But here, it's reinterpreted as a profound collapse of viable possibility and a contraction of action.
The organism basically initiates a systemic shutdown to conserve whatever minimal margin is left.
Exactly. And anxiety is the opposite. It's threat-saturated coupling. The organism is afraid of its own regulatory signals.
Yeah.
PTSD is danger worlds persisting after the danger has passed. The emotioning remains locked in survival mode.
There's a vignette in the paper that I want to share. It's called Panic After Bereavement.
Walk us through it.
A patient comes to the clinic having severe panic attacks, waking up convinced they're having a heart attack right after a parent's sudden death. The traditional diagnosis is just panic disorder. Here's an SSRI, go do some breathing exercises.
But the life coherence formulation looks at the biology of the grief. The death removed a massive relational anchor, which is a loss of margin.
Right. And the body now reads ordinary cardiac acceleration, just their heart beating a little faster as impending death. That's the constraint and perception.
Healing requires grief work and relational anchoring, not just breathing exercises. The symptoms are locked, domains of action. A clinician who ignores the biological emotioning might offer technically correct advice that the patient literally cannot receive because they are locked in a domain of threat.
Okay, but what happens when the environment itself is the primary driver of the mismatch? Let's talk about conditions involving altered reality or environmental mismatches, starting with addiction.
Addiction is framed brilliantly as narrowed regulation around relief. The option field collapses to one regulatory pathway.
Because that one substance is incredibly effective at altering the perception of distress, right?
Exactly. But it destroys the organism's margins in the process. Treatment has to slowly rebuild options. It can't just be removing the substance.
And what about psychosis and mania? The paper describes these as altered salience and self-world boundaries. Signals become over-meaningful.
There's another vignette here, vignette 3, about psychosis and humiliation. A young adult develops persecutory beliefs, thinking people are plotting against them after prolonged severe bullying.
The traditional view is just prescribe antipsychotics, suppress the delusion.
But the framework asks a radical question. Does the terrifying psychotic world protect against the unbearable alternative of feeling humiliated and totally abandoned? A conspiracy implies you are important. It's a desperate regulatory defense.
Wow. And then there's vignette 2, caregiver burnout. An older adult caring for a spouse with dementia comes in with major depression.
Right.
The paper views the depression as the lived expression of an impossible coupling pattern, love, duty, and total exhaustion. The first intervention isn't an antidepressant. It might simply be respite care to restore margin.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, it highlights how revolutionary the neurodevelopmental framing is too. Autism and ADHD.
Oh, yes. The paper explicitly frames these as coupling mismatches rather than simple deficits.
Think about the distress we see in autism or ADHD. It often arises from chronic correction, masking, and environments demanding narrow forms of performance.
It goes back to the fern analogy. You put a fern in a desert, and when it wilts, you call it defective. but it's just a coupling mismatch.
Exactly. The therapy isn't fixing the person, but accommodating the environment for a viable coupling.
Looking at all these disorders, Dr. Sowley notes that certain patterns repeat. Instead of stacking diagnostic boxes like someone having depression, PTSD, and addiction, the paper offers 5 cross-cutting process logics.
This is clinically massive, those logics are. Threat saturation, collapse of possibility, altered salience, narrowed regulation, and coupling mismatch.
It's so much cleaner. A patient with 4 diagnoses might actually just be suffering from 1 core process logic. Their system is organized around threat, which narrowed their regulation to a substance, which collapsed their possibilities.
It's a single cascade.
It's like diagnosing a car with a broken radio, bad AC, and flickering headlights, when the actual process logic is just a dying alternator. You treat the core regulatory failure.
That's a perfect analogy.
So let me ask you, the listener, a question. Have you ever felt narrowed regulation in your own life? Where one coping mechanism, maybe scrolling endlessly on your phone or overworking, took over because your options felt constrained. It happens to all of us.
It does. It really does.
So if we understand illness as a breakdown in living coherence, how do we actually heal?
The paper outlines a sequence for treatment. Stabilize safety, restore margin, name the pattern, reopen felt sense, and expand options.
Right.
And we have to emphasize that symptom suppression, like medication, is often a necessary and viable beginning. But durable healing requires viable recoupling.
Which involves biological support, psychotherapy, relational repair, and even changing the community or the medium itself.
Exactly. And this is where the paper draws heavily on the World Health Organization's framing of social determinants. Environments, poverty, displacement, and institutional demands directly alter the medium organisms try to survive in.
And as a reminder for you listening, we're impartially reporting this. The paper uses WHO data to say policy, like housing or work protections, is a biological mental health intervention because it dictates the structural coupling of the population.
Yes, the author is making a public health interpretation of biological data.
We aren't taking a political stance here, just explaining the author's conclusions. But before we wrap up, we need to quickly review the author's own safeguards and limitations.
Right. First, do not romanticize dangerous states. Psychosis and severe addiction require robust clinical intervention. Second, always rule out medical causes.
Like a brain tumor.
Exactly. And third, practice cultural humility. What counts as dignity or viable coupling varies wildly by culture.
So what does this all mean? Mental health is not just the absence of a disorder. It is the capacity for living coherence, conserving your biological integrity, remaining coupled with your world, feeling your emotions truthfully, and participating in shared meaning.
To close out, think about the last time you felt profound anxiety or distress. What if that feeling wasn't a malfunction of your brain, but your biological system working exactly as intended? Accurately sensing that the environment you are structurally coupled with is currently unlivable.
Oh, wow.
And if that is true, what is the smallest option you have today to begin a more viable recoupling with your world?
A brilliant question to end on. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive into the source material. We hope this gives you a powerful new lens to view your own mind and body. Stay insanely curious, and we will catch you on the next one.